Last week, I spoke about the heart of ethical practice, the essence of which is non-harming. And I offered a number of different ways. I think I pointed out four different ways of practicing non-harming. And urged us to remember to practice during the week especially and come back and share some of what we found. How many people did actually give some attention to the practice of non-harming? That's great. So a little bit later I'll really invite you to share some of what you might have seen and found. And what I want to do this evening, really three things. I want to review briefly some of what we covered last time. Partly, how many people were not here last week? Oh, that's a lot. And so I want to review briefly what we explored last time. Secondly, hear some of what those who practiced might have found, some of the insights, questions, challenges. And then thirdly, I want to focus probably for most of the talk on, as it were, a second level of practice. And so my theme will be 10 ways of deepening the practice of non-harming, of which each of us surely only needs one or two. But I'll offer 10 with the hope of inspiring many of us to see which ones one resonates with. So I mentioned last time that ethical practice is one of the three core areas of traditional practice in the Buddhist tradition, along with training in meditation and training in wisdom. And they're all interrelated. And that's actually a key point, that the three areas of training can be seen in the Eightfold Path. And in fact, each of the eight fit in one of those three areas. And so the overall training covers those eight areas, which are expressions or part of the training in each of those three areas. They're not the totality, but they capture some of the main aspects of training. So what's called right view or mature view, aspiration, those are aspects of wisdom, speech, action, livelihood, aspects of ethical practice, and then effort, meditation, or effort, mindfulness, and concentration, aspects of the training in meditation. And there's something parallel, some of you may have explored Tibetan tradition, there's something parallel that practice is really understood in these three main ways in terms of developing the view, which corresponds to wisdom, developing meditation, and then developing conduct, which corresponds to ethical practice. So it's quite similar in many of the other Buddhist traditions. And yet I made the point last time that interestingly, ethical practice has not been at the center of Western Buddhist practice. In fact, I think I started last time by saying I want to talk about something that is rarely explored in Dharma talks, right? And I think that's true, that perhaps not, the focus has really been especially on meditation, to some extent on wisdom, but especially on meditation. I think understandably, because the meditative or contemplative dimension of the Western religious traditions have been marginalized or lost for 500 to 1,000 years. So you're not easy to find. I mean, I remember I had some Jewish friends who wanted to find Jewish contemplative tradition and searched for years and years and finally found, this was maybe 20 or 30 years ago, finally found some teachers in Israel who taught the old mystical teachings of the Kabbalah. Now it's more common. One can find Christian, Jewish, Islamic teachings of a contemplative nature, but 40, 50 years ago, not easy to find. You had to go to like the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky to find a Trappist approach to contemplative Christianity, or you had to know about that, which most people didn't know about. So, interestingly, there's been somewhat of a marginalization or lessening of the centrality of ethical practice, which is, in a way, unfortunate, and I hope we can sort of remedy that, you know, as a whole in Western practice. Traditionally, ethical practice was particularly guided by precepts, which numbered over 200 for monks and nuns, 5 for lay people. And those are the familiar precepts that are really variants of non-harming. The first being not killing, or more generally, not harming. The second being not taking that which is not given, not stealing, we might say. So some correspondence to the Ten Commandments. The third, fourth, and fifth being careful with energies which can be confusing and disorienting: sexuality, speech, and intoxicants. So there's some guidance on those. When you read the text, the emphasis on non-harming is very central. And I read some passages last time. I just wanted to read a few of those. This is from the Buddha: not to commit evil, to practice all that is good, to keep the heart pure. This is the teaching of the Buddha. And there is a way that the ethical practice is the natural expression of the development of wisdom, of the heart, of meditation. Not so hard to see when we think of teachings like those of interdependence, of mutual connection with all beings, with all phenomena, or when we point to some of the deeper experiences of what in some traditions, some Buddhist traditions, are called Buddha nature, or the nature of mind, or our deep nature, which goes beyond the individual self. And again, remember the wisdom teachings, which we've explored here quite a number of times, of anatta, or not self, really would go hand in hand with non-harming and the ethical teachings. We also look to some extent at how ethical practice is really a matter of training. All of the ethical guidelines in the original language, when you translate them, they all start with the passage, short passage or short phrase, for the sake of training. And so the working with the ethical guidelines in our daily lives is a kind of training. It's not so much looked at as like a commandment that if you don't follow, you'll be struck down by lightning or in some way harmed. Or it's really about training and continually missing following the precepts, following the guideline, as we did last time, of non-harming, and continually harming. But the context of training means that we can learn from it. So we set up, as it were, a learning model. We follow this guideline, and when we fall short, and when we harm, or when we in some way violate or get close to violating one of the ethical guidelines, we take it as part of our learning. And we know that we're always going to fall short, but we can learn from it. So taking the precept has a somewhat different attitude than some other ethical guidelines where one's supposed to be perfect, and if you're not, either others will punish you or you'll become self-judgmental and punish yourself. And this is important because a few of us here, maybe like 80%, may have had training to be perfectionistic. Does anyone confess to that? Moi? Okay, that's why I'm writing a book on transforming the judgmental mind. It's not just because I thought it was a really neat topic. Okay. So there are training guidelines. And the other thing that's important to remember about the ethical guidelines is that they're framed negatively, but they really point to positive qualities being developed. And my understanding of the terms in the original language, and I've talked with some scholars about this, is that the terms like ahimsa, which could be translated as non-harming, which is the teaching that Gandhi used to develop non-violence, that the connotations in the original language are more positive. They would include qualities of care and even love as included in the meaning of what it means to follow the precepts. So following the guideline of non-harming means also to cultivate care, love, compassion, a kind heart, to have that pure heart in relationship to oneself and others. So I focused last time on non-harming, the first of the precepts, and in most Buddhist traditions, seen as the most important of the five. And you could also say that the other four express variants of non-harming in specific contexts. From the Buddha, one must not hate any being and cannot kill a living creature even in thought. So you can see in that passage, there's a connection of non-hating, or in other words, caring, developing loving kindness, and non-harming. And we'll come back to that later. It's a very crucial connection between the kind heart and non-harming. Their non-harming is expression of the kind heart. And so when we looked last time, we looked at four ways of practicing non-harming, very down-to-earth ways of practicing. And since I gave those four, I've thought of one more, at least one more. And so the ones I gave last time were first working with the intention not to harm and bringing this into one's maybe morning meditation, framing your day by saying, today I will practice non-harming. Something like that. In whatever way you work best with intention. Could be remembering it at the end of your meditation, could be writing it on your refrigerator, presumably with the agreement of your household. It could mean doing some ritual in which you remember it. Might mean remembering the intention more than once a day, maybe in the morning and the afternoon. What keeps it alive? What keeps that remembering? It's going back to that fact of practice, that practice itself is not so hard. Remembering to practice is quite hard. There's that truism. We don't have as many reminders as we would if we were living in a monastery. Right? Or you go to a retreat, all sorts of reminders. Practice, practice, practice. At home, might be the opposite. Distraction. Don't practice. Don't practice. Oh, here's a nice way that you won't pay attention. Here's a nice way to get lost, right, for a while. Very pleasurable. Not harmful. And so forth. So first way of practicing was intention. The second way of practicing was to notice when you come up in the flow of daily life to some way that you're in some ways either violating the precept of non-harming, or going into at least an ambiguous or so-called gray area. Anyone notice any gray areas? Yeah, and then bringing mindfulness. What's going on in my mind, my body, my heart? What am I doing? What's my motivation? And really studying. So in that way, you see how mindfulness and the ethical precept go hand in hand. Following the ethical precept is also an invitation to bring mindfulness when we're not following the precept, or when something comes up, or the another way of saying it is that the precept can be there, and when we're getting in that gray area or even violating the precept, it's like a tripwire brings up our mindfulness. It's a second way to practice and really to explore what's going on. What am I doing? What's in my mind? And this is related to the further way of practicing non-harming that I didn't mention last time, which is kind of obvious, maybe understood, was let the intention guide your behavior. Right? Try to really practice non-harming. I think that flows from the intention that it's going to really guide behavior. The fourth way of practicing that I gave was to cultivate the heart in some way. Most of us know loving-kindness practice. And if non-harming is really the natural expression of kindness and kind heart, then practicing one of the heart practices, such as loving-kindness or compassion for others, maybe forgiveness especially, would really make a difference for our practice. It would help us to, in a sense, lead more with our hearts in every situation, which is a powerful way to practice non-harming. It's very hard to come at a situation and, in a sense, lead with one's kind heart and harm. It's possible, but it's harder. And it might be loving kindness, it might be compassion. It also could be compassion when we fall short of the guideline of non-harming, or forgiveness. If we're practicing non-harming regularly, something like forgiveness could be very, very helpful. You know, one of my cutting edges of practice, as I've mentioned at times, is working with telemarketers. And occasionally I go into either the gray area or in some way I violate the precept of non-harming with telemarketers. And I try, if I have to do that, I try to follow it by forgiveness, more for the kind of cleansing of my own heart. Right? So one of the heart, having forgiveness or one of the other heart practices like compassion can really go hand in hand with practice of non-harming. And then the last type of practice that I suggested was related to seeing that there's a lot of harming going on in the larger world. We could see that there's harm that's occurring at the social dimension, politically, economically, ecologically, right? And so what is one's response to that harm? And for many of us, I think I asked the question last time, many of us know that harm is being done, would like to respond, but don't know what to do. Some know where they're drawn, and I'll come back to that. And so that could be a fourth dimension. I think last time I more particularly for those people who felt drawn to respond, but weren't sure how, just to reflect on that. What would be a skillful response? And last time I did give ways in which, both in the very traditional teachings and in contemporary understandings of non-harming, there we could see that there is a social dimension. It's not just about doing what is best or practicing non-harming in my face-to-face interactions. And so with the Buddha, in the Sutta Nipata, there's a passage which says, let one not destroy life, nor cause others to destroy. It didn't have the same understanding we have of how we're in some ways complicit with what governments do or with what larger communities do. But there are lines where it says, do not cause others to harm. It's not just about what one does oneself, nor approve of others harming. You have passages like that. And I also read last time from Thich Nhat Hanh, passage, some of you know his work. And he has a whole very nice book on the ethical precepts. I think it's called For a Future to be Possible, which he did over 20 years ago. But still very, very nice. I am determined, he said, not to kill, not to let others kill. So he takes that even further in his understanding of the precept. Not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking and in my way of life. You can generalize that, harming. So what did you find? I wanted to, maybe we could have someone help with the microphone. Anyone want to share some of what you found? Maybe an insight as well as a challenge that you found, what was hard about doing this? Anyone like to share? Jim, please.
Well, I just noticed a little bit more. I commute into San Francisco and back every day. That's what they should say it all to the Civic Center.
Yeah.
And just, wanting to harm, wanting to, just falling short, just being aware of reacting to drivers, et cetera, situations.
So driving does at times bring out at least the intention to harm, or at least negative thoughts, right? And so one could take, I've been taking driving as a practice. I think I forgot it this evening, but.
Yeah, I think of you sometimes.
Because I talk about that, right? So you could take driving as one of your fundamental places to practice non-harming, while being suitably taking care of yourself. Right? Yeah.
But I also get in there with some metta. There's lots of opportunity for metta.
Metta while driving?
Not while I'm walking around, while I'm going through the Civic Center.
Yeah, but bringing around, bringing the heart out.
Instead of get away from me or whatever.
Right, in terms of people who are not well off. Yeah, thank you. Great. Why don't we say our names as well,
so everyone knows. This is Corey. I noticed the first week of taking on a practice, I often just notice mostly when I'm not meeting the practice. So I noticed that an awful lot this week. Where I found more success then was in having compassion for myself, not doubling down, not making it worse,
right,
beating myself up as much. So I did recall it in some instances there. And then I reflected a little bit on the complicit piece. And where I really struggle with that is when I'm in a group of people or with another person and they start to speak badly of someone else. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it puts me in a bind, because I feel like when I try to offer some insight into maybe this is why they did that or whatever, sometimes I get a negative response. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like I have introduced a conflict with this person. So it's an interesting, and what a place to practice for me.
It's a great, the most fundamental thing here is make these areas of practice. Mm-hmm. There's not necessarily a general right way to act and so forth, but to yeah, to bring in the issue of complicity, whether in a social setting or more generally in, in our connection with the larger society. So it's helpful. Thanks.
Chris, a week before last, Wednesday before last, Sylvia was talking at Spirit Rock, and she was talking about Operation Anthropoid. She was reading this book called HHH, mm-hmm. which delved into the assassination of Reinhold Heydrich in Prague in 1944, I believe. And there was a movie about it, Project Anthropoid.
Yeah, I think it was earlier. Yeah.
It was earlier, like 38.
I think 38, yeah.
Yeah, 38. It was earlier. Yeah. Oh, right after the invasion. Anyway.
No, after I think right after Kristallnacht.
Right, the annexation of Czech. But I got the dates wrong. But anyway, I was a little surprised that Sylvia would talk about this assassination.
Yeah.
You know? And but what I was delving into on non-harming is it's difficult.
Yeah.
Because the more I thought about it, the more tangled it became. And whether you fight evil or do you fight evil? Ajahn Chah said something, and he said, "Don't fight evil. Why are we fighting evil? Don't fight it." So it's just interesting that, and I hate to go to the German Reich as the example, but Sylvia brought it up, so I figured it was
very right. Yeah, and a lot of questions come up, of course. A lot of dimensions of non-harming in our daily lives are quite straightforward and not challenging in terms of practice. But when we get to certain issues, and the Nazis are one of the extreme examples, and there was a very interesting dialogue back and forth in writing between Gandhi and Martin Buber about nonviolence. I think it was in 1938. Around that time. So it was a very interesting dialogue about the possibility of nonviolence in relation to Nazis. That was before the clarity about the final solution, so it was an earlier time. But still, one of the core expressions of non-harming, in the context of addressing harm being done, are the traditions of nonviolence coming from Gandhi, King, Dorothy Day, and many others. And of course there, I'll talk a little bit about this later, because I think it's one of the areas that studying it can be very helpful for deepening practice. So I'll come back to that. But that, there, of course, the idea is that one can be very, very strong in response, but not injure others. And we have the laboratories where that was attempted. And it's not, I won't go into this so much, it's not so well known, but nonviolence was used successfully a number of times against the Nazis. The examples are not well known, I could go into them. One of them was, a demonstration by German women who were married to Jewish men. And for a long time under the Nazis, those men were safe. And in 1943, they were rounded up and about to be sent to Auschwitz. The wives gathered in front of Gestapo headquarters for days, and the Nazis released the men. That's true. Now, they weren't saying we're going to practice like Gandhi, but it actually happened that way. Yeah. So let me take one more, and then I'll go on. Yeah. And this is, again, invitation, not so much to discuss what someone else said, but to talk about your own experience. During the last week, yeah.
Confusion has suddenly come to my head. Last week, before I came here and knew what you were going to talk about, I had injured a teeny tiny bug.
Oh, yeah.
Accidentally.
A little closer.
Last week, before I came here, knew what you were talking about, I had injured this really teeny tiny fragile bug on my sink. And it was sort of tippling around, and I was struggling with, well, should I put it out of its misery, or should I leave it with its life? And I just waited, and then it was fine. And it flew away, and I was really happy. Uh-huh. But more importantly, you reminded me tonight that I've been doing a forgiveness practice for myself and others. And I've forgotten about doing it, the distraction of daily life. And I was talking with a friend today who was escalating anger toward her mother. And I, like somebody else was just saying, I wanted to say, well, maybe this was happening for her. But I realized I had to give my friend acknowledgement first, sort of NBC style empathy and acknowledgement. And it was interesting, though, because I immediately wanted to go to calming her down and giving her a reason why her mother did this repeatedly over the years. But I realized that, that I needed to acknowledge what she was experiencing, too. So it is a practice, and it's sort of...
Yeah, it's a practice, and practice means that it's not always clear, but that we're guided by an intention. Sometimes it's messy. A lot of times it's messy. Sometimes we don't know what to do. That's the nature of a practice. But in a sense, with a practice, we have a North Star that's guiding us, even if we can't interpret its meaning in the context of this particular situation very well. But the questioning, the inquiry, is very valuable. It's really what... So non-harming is a practice. I'm sorry to say this. Tonight, we are not. I'm not trying to give you easy answers to one's life. In fact, I'm trying to help things be more confusing. In some ways. In some ways, not. Okay. So let me give my 10 ways of deepening the practice of non-harming. I'm going to be somewhat brief on these. Each of these could be a talk. Okay? So 10 ways. Listen to these 10 and see which one or two resonate with you that you even might consider following. Okay? If you want to follow all 10, don't do it. It's too much. Just one or two, maybe three. Okay? So here's one way. Number one. Stay with the focus on non-harming for 1 or 2 months. Just do what many of us did last week, following something like those 5 practices I gave. And again, I mentioned at the end, I think, last time, if 5 is too much, do 1 or 2 of them. See how you want, in a very simple way, practice non-harming. So this is deepening it by letting the duration be longer, letting the time of learning be longer. It's one way to deepen your practice. Second way might be to look at any ways that you're actually harming yourself. Am I harming myself in some ways? It's a question you probably don't ask that much. Maybe some of us notice ways that we may harm ourselves by certain behaviors. Maybe it could be related to not doing what we know is best in some part of our life. Or it could be noticing a very self-judgmental voice that in a sense is harming, is causing harm, and working with that. There's this beautiful passage from the Buddha in which he says, one who loves oneself will never harm another. It's another expression of the connection between non-harming and the kind heart. But it's a very powerful passage because it really suggests that if we really care for ourselves, that is a fundamental way to practice non-harming. And so we can see, where am I not caring for myself adequately? Where am I harming? Bring care to those situations is a really beautiful way to practice non-harming. It's also a very powerful statement because it helps us to see, when we look in the world, how much harming of others, including harming of others, comes out of a lack of love for oneself. I mean, a lot of psychologists have pointed out versions of that for a long time, right? That, you know, the greatest single correlation of those committing violence is that violence has been done to them. Some sort of hurt, trauma, whatever. Okay. So related to this, number three, a way to cultivate non-harming, a beautiful way, have a heart practice that you do every day. Practice loving kindness every day. That will have a big impact on non-harming. Just that even if you do it 5 or 10 minutes a day, that will have a big impact. And again, something like loving kindness. I use heart practice to mean loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness, joy, equanimity, what you'll be doing next weekend. It could be gratitude. Any of these practices done regularly will have a big impact. And the last, I'm grouping the 10 in terms of whether it's about individual practice, about our relational practice, being with others, and then the third area is relating to the larger social world. So the first four are more about our individual practice. So then the fourth, study further, this is a way of deepening the practice, study further the various teachings on ethical practice. What you find from the Buddha, what you find in people who've gone at some length to clarify ethical practice, like Thich Nhat Hanh in the book For a Future to be Possible. I think in my, I have a reading list there which has a listing of 6 or 7 books on ethical practice. Yeah, my book that's over there, The Engaged Spiritual Life, has quite a lot of depth on ethical practice. I think the first 2 chapters. Okay, number 5. We're making good progress. Number 5. Find a way to bring a commitment to non-harming into family and work context. And one way to do that is by having explicit agreements within work or family context. Sometimes people do this for online communities as well. And so having agreements is a wonderful way to practice non-harming in a, again, family, organization, workplace. You know, for example, I was able to get, when I was connected with Saybrook Graduate School, we had a lot of communication challenges, and we had a committee that I was part of, and they agreed, people really liked, I think without saying that it was Buddhist-based, I gave the guidelines for skillful speech, and people really liked them. And I think I've mentioned from time to time that the organization, or at least the faculty, agreed to abide by these ethical guidelines, which are really about non-harming in the context of speech. And they had me at the beginning of every meeting recite them. You can do that in organizations, families, whatever. Make agreements. It's a really powerful way to practice non-harming in relational or organizational context.
Can you provide those for us?
Yeah. I think some of them I think may be in my book, but I could share. I could send an email. Who do I send it to?
We're in
Sangha. We're in Sangha. Okay. So we'll put this. We'll get it to the whole Sangha in some way.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so related to that, it's helpful to learn, this is still number 5, it's helpful to learn how to be skillful with conflict. That's a big part of working with non-harming. That could have been its own number, but I didn't want to have 11. Number six, it's kind of related also, work with skillful speech. Have the development of connection and compassionate speaking be at the center of your every word you say. Can you do that? When you take speech practice as fundamental guideline, it's a beautiful way of practicing non-harming, because it really is about having at the center of your speech wanting to connect in an empathic and compassionate way with others, even when they're difficulties, even when they're conflicts. Work with skillful speech is the sixth one. Yeah, we could say a lot about that. This is from a Tibetan teacher, Patril Rinpoche. Everything you say with your mouth or do with your hands, instead of being harmful to others, should be straightforward and kind. Okay. And then the last four are about this dimension of relating to the larger social world, where there's a lot of harm. One of them would be to consider shifting to a plant-based diet. This will radically reduce several types of harm. So, for example, of course, this doesn't reduce all harm, but it reduces the harm done to sentient beings. And again, we know that most animals that are prepared for the meat that's sold in mainstream markets are kept in pretty horrendous conditions, right? And the conditions are so bad that they're filled with antibiotics to prevent them from dying prematurely of disease, and antibiotics which are not healthy for humans to ingest, but they're part of what happens when one eats meat. And then a second major point, of course, is that a plant-based diet is one of the most significant responses one can have to climate issues. In the book by Paul Hawken, who lives in Marin, called Drawdown, where he gives 100 ways to respond to climate change that would actually reverse climate change. Maintaining a plant-based diet is one of the four most impactful ways to respond to climate change. You can probably find more detail on that if you look at the website called Drawdown. So that's a seventh, considering a change in diet. An eighth is looking at one's own attitudes towards particular groups that we're one which are, as it were, the recipients of certain kinds of discriminatory actions. So looking at one's own attitudes related to race, gender, sexual orientation, age, and religion, and so forth. And I've been reading this book that some of you may know called Blind Spot, which is by some of the people who developed the notion of implicit bias. It's quite an interesting book. It's, some aspects are controversial, but it's quite well done. It's subtitled The Hidden Biases of Good People, meaning people who explicitly would profess not to want to be biased. And yet, the research seems to show that we have enormous amount of biases. One of the findings that I was reading about yesterday was that actually, of all these different biases, you know what the strongest one is? It's against the elderly. It's against older people. I'm not saying it has, you know, had the most effect historically, but it's the most pervasive. And it actually found in a number of other countries. And the nature of these biases is that they are internalized by people who are in the groups that are discriminated against. So the elderly are biased against themselves. Those who are older have those biases. So this eighth way of practicing is to really look at that, especially helpful to do it in a group made up of people in the same group, to be in a group where you look at issues of race. I've been in two groups, maybe more, but two in the last 4 years where we've looked at whiteness. One of them was at the East Bay Meditation Center, a six-month program. Another one, I facilitated for almost 4 years a group of white Dharma teachers, many of them connected with Spirit Rock. We read books together, we talked about our teaching, we talked about our personal background. There was kind of a no-shame approach. Anything you said was okay, right? Because people have to be really honest in this. And that they were really helpful. You know, and so to do something like that, or to do it around age, really interesting to see that finding. There's actually research that shows that older people who have negative views about being old are more likely to have heart disease, as well as some other illnesses. I think more likely to get Alzheimer's. There's pretty good research on that. So, okay, that was number 8. Number 9, study nonviolence. Study the nonviolence of Gandhi, King, Dorothy Day, others. And look at the relationship to ethical practice in the Buddhist tradition. You know, I have some talks on Dharma Seed on this topic. I've done retreats and daylongs at time on that topic. And just to see, you know, Dr. King, a few passages. He said, the means must be as pure as the ends. In confronting harm, the means must be as pure as the end. The end represents the means in process and the ideal in the making. One must follow a consistent principle of non-injury and consistently refuse to inflict injury upon another. One seeks to defeat the unjust system rather than the individuals who are caught in the system. So study those traditions, very, very rich responses to some of what we've looked at, all sorts of tools. One person, one scholar of nonviolence, Gene Sharp, has a book where I think he has close to 200 tactics of nonviolence, which do not injure people physically, but can be very powerful and, in a sense, confrontative. And number 10, last one, commit to acting against one particular form of harm. So take on one issue and work on it. Climate issues, you know, race and racism, ageism, whatever it is. Make a commitment. And remember, I'm naming 10, inviting you to take one or two. So the 10th one is to take one issue. Don't do everything, but take one issue and work on it. It's a very important way to proceed. Don't try to do everything. Do one thing and really put in your time. Put in 5 hours a week on one issue. That'll do something. So I think I'll end partly by noting that it's going up to the 4th of July. So I thought I'd have a few 4th of July quotes to end. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among humans, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying the foundations on such principles and organizing the powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
How timely is that?
That's 1776. Okay?
Declaration.
Okay. And again, from Dr. King, in a real sense, America is essentially a dream as yet unfulfilled. It is a dream of a land where people of all races, all nationalities, and all creeds can live together as brothers and sisters. The substance of the dream is expressed in these sublime words, lifted to cosmic proportions. And he quotes what I just read. I'll I'll end with Gary Snyder. The mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the basic self-void. We need both. This is, by the way, from 1961. They are both contained in the traditional three aspects of the Dhamma path: wisdom, meditation, and ethics. Wisdom is intuitive knowledge of the mind of love and clarity that lies beneath one's ego-driven anxieties and aggressions. Meditation is going into the mind to see this for yourself over and over again until it becomes the mind you live in. Ethics is bringing it back out in the way you live through personal example and responsible action, ultimately towards the true community of all beings. So that's our practice on July 4th, as well as every other day. Thank you. So again, reflections, questions, observations.
You said 200 acts.
Let's use the microphone.
No, 200 acts. I just need, who had the 200?
Oh, we'll use the mic, or I'll just respond. The question was about the 200 nonviolent actions.
Yes.
And the author is Jean Sharp, S-H-A-R-P.
Thank you.
And I think the book is called, might be called just Nonviolent Action, but if you look under his name, you'll find it.
Okay.
And anyone know the title? Remember it? I think it's, yeah. Okay. Please. Wait for the mic. No.
The quote from Gary Snyder, what was that from?
That was, it's found in his book called Earth Household. It was from 1961. It was from, I think, an early version of the Whole Earth catalog, if I remember right. It was a journal to protect all beings, which was around for some of the time in the 1960s. From 1961, it was actually the same year as the King quote about America as being a dream, same year.
Yeah. Could you send it to Marin Sangha when you sent the other thing that you sent me?
Yes. Can someone remind me? Could you remind me? I don't seem to have my pen. Turn that down. Okay. Other reflections, questions of any kind? Or anything you'd like to say? Yeah.
Well, this is going to sound a little silly, but I have a dog. I got a puppy last year, and she has a lot of anxiety, phobia, and some trauma, and although she's amazing. And we're doing private training, and the practice is, it's positive.
Yeah.
So you don't tell them no, you reward and reinforce the behavior that you want.
Yeah.
And I am finding so much of awareness and teaching for me that I'm learning about myself in terms of my how I react immediately to say no and to try and stop the negative as opposed to, so it's really an opportunity for me to kind of look inside and
that's great.
Practice with the Dharma in a way, but boy, is it hard. It's amazing how automated.
It's hard, but it's that you're pointing to really important aspect of our practice. It's related to some things that I was saying earlier about how the whole spirit of ethical practice and of non-harming is to really cultivate the positive, see everything as training, see everything as learning, and watch out for those negative attitudes towards, oh, I blew it, or I'm unethical, or I didn't do what was right, to watch out, because that conditioning is strong in the culture and it's strong in a lot of us, right? And so, and it's interesting, I think also one doesn't only train puppies like that, it's actually been a very important way that sports teams have worked.
Yeah.
I think the success of the Golden State Warriors is very connected with that philosophy. You know, it's, you know, sometimes attributed to Stephen Curry, but the focus on joy in training and in playing. So thought I'd make that connection.
Well, you know, the thing that you brought up and the thing that comes up about very harmful acts performed in the world, but just it reminded me of a story about Dipa Ma, and somebody was poking at her, well, what would you do in this and that situation, quoting harmful situations.
Right.
And one of the things they poked at her, well, what if somebody was wanting to harm your daughter?
Yeah.
And she said, I would stop them, but there would be no animosity in the stopping. It would just stop them. And so, I mean, my issue, which I think many people have, you hear about some harmful act being performed somewhere in our country or somewhere else, and you get angry and irate, and the stopping, you know, wanting to stop it, is not a pure thing. It's tinged with animosity and wanting to kill or hate or whatever, and that's difficult.
Yeah. So, again, again, that teaching can be there. Dipa Ma, by the way, was a woman who influenced a lot of Western practitioners. She was from Calcutta. I met her. I spent some time with her in the early 90s. I spent time with her in the late 70s, sorry. She died in 91. There's a very nice book on her life. But yeah, what you're pointing to in terms of the complexities is part of what we go into if one's interested in changing, transforming social harm, as we've looked at that. It is messy, it's not clear, but we have some very good guides.